cliffcentral.com. At Sibanye, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. We are proud of our partnership with the Leadership Platform and will continue to support leaders who are committed to growing our country. Sibanye, we are one. Visit us on sibanyegold.co.za.
Grant, I need to make a critical business decision. We've been expanding rapidly, and my gut feel tells me that we should be investing for growth. But I need to put some financial science behind that gut feel of mine.
Don't you have a financial manager or director that can help you with that?
But isn't that rather expensive?
It doesn't have to be. Why don't you contact the finance team? They're a consultancy that can provide you with a part-time financial manager or director at a fraction of the cost of a full-time resource.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to our business masterclass. The first half of our first half of the hour of the business skills conversation is in association with USB Ed. I'm Richard Angus from the finance team. Last week we chatted with Belinda Wagner on the world of customer lifetime value. It was a great show, worthy of downloading that podcast. Today's theme with Sean Cunningham is about knowledge management concepts that are critical to your business. So joining me today in the studio, USB Ed faculty member Sean Cunningham, Dr. Sean Cunningham, should I say, he's a change consultant working across multiple fields of competitiveness improvement within economies, industries, and companies. In the average year, I understand Sean works across the world in between 12 and 15 odd countries. So, Sean, thanks for being here today for us. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Richard.
So, Sean, the whole world of knowledge management, I mean, it's a phrase that's kind of thrown out there very quickly on people's tongues, knowledge management. What is knowledge management? Why do companies even talk about it? Why is it it's kind of one of those buzzwords, you know, one of those big words that people throw out when they need something to say. But what is knowledge management in your perspective?
So I think it's necessary to first start by unpacking knowledge, and then we can see how one could possibly manage that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we did make a distinction between knowledge and information and data, then everybody would agree data is about facts. It's about numbers, words, the kind of things that one can measure or observe or maybe keep track of. Information then is when we start recognizing patterns or we start structuring this data so that we can make sense of it. So we are in a world awash with information. We're actually drowning in a lot of information.
I was going to say, I think we're drowning in information. Pass the Twitter there.
Yeah. Yes. And then the knowledge part then is, this is where your team, your people or individuals try to make sense of all of this stuff. It's a lot about beliefs. It's about personal commitment. It's about bias. It's about perception. So knowledge itself is very often not just about your degree and the stuff that you know. It's also about how you perceive what's going on around you and what you decide to filter in or filter out.
Mm. So it's about being selective, I guess. And I guess then, maybe if I could say it, knowledge also then obviously has a kind of, let's call it a connectedness with the perspective you take or the lens through which you look on the world. So your knowledge is informed by your circumstances, your perspectives, your background, your education, your upbringing, etc. And that kind of filters out some of the information and makes logical sense of it, I would imagine.
Well, what you've just done now is you've almost given a summary then of what is knowledge management. Because,
okay,
you know, if you go and look in a textbook what knowledge management is, it would very often focus on explicit knowledge, you know, the kind of knowledge that you can capture and record. I mean, you come from a financial sector. There's a lot of knowledge that is contained in financial statements and in the financial press, for instance.
Mm.
The role of a leader in knowledge management is to try and harness the kind of knowledge that their teams or their organization would be creating. So the problem just with the selection thing is that a lot of it is not conscious. A lot of it, we don't even know what knowledge we are cutting out, what information we're ignoring.
We don't know what we don't know. And you know, sometimes I think we struggle to know what we do know.
Yes.
We're given so much. Now, I mean, what are the dimensions of knowledge management? I mean, when we talk of the dimensions of knowledge management, what would those elements be?
So the first thing that one must start off with is knowledge management, according to me, is not a function. So it's not something we can delegate to one person. It's something that you need
okay,
to get.
So this whole thing of I'm the knowledge officer, that concept?
Let me state it controversial and say if you're the knowledge officer, you're most likely the person that's recording all the spreadsheets, chasing people for case studies and reports and data.
Okay.
So knowledge management for me is something that leadership should take responsibility of, but they should know that everybody in their organization is involved in creating knowledge or hiding knowledge. So you asked about the dimensions.
Yep.
So there's obviously the very explicit part of knowledge. These are the facts that we have at our disposal. These are the things that we know. These are the kind of things that we can observe in the organization. So, and we can codify these things. So you and I can sit down and write up some of your experiences. We can codify some of this knowledge. And in organizations, this kind of knowledge is often codified in systems and procedures, but also in manuals, in policies, and in day-to-day, you know, operational data. So that is the formal part of knowledge. The informal or the tacit knowledge is the kind of knowledge that your team members would have or that you would have that you almost can't explain.
Now, so if I was to translate that into, let's call it layman's terms, the first type of knowledge you're referring to, that documented knowledge, that's the stuff that you can see, touch, feel, and get a handle on.
Yeah.
What you're referring to now is the stuff that really gets you into trouble because it's the stuff that isn't well known and doesn't move easily in an organization.
Yeah. So it's the kind of knowledge that, for instance, you know, you could imagine a mechanic, they just know how to turn. They just know exactly how far to turn a nut just before it strips.
Okay.
You know, where a layman would turn the thing until it breaks off and then think it was just a poor quality nut.
Poor quality nut, yeah.
You know, so that tacit knowledge. And in your workforce, your problem is that a part of your workforce is probably earning their living with tacit knowledge. And we don't tap into that often enough. We don't equip people with that. And this tacit...
We often call this intellectual property. Am I right? I mean, people will say, I've got intellectual property. I know how things work around here. And it's not in a book and it's not in a process guide and it's not there or everywhere. And my comment would be, and I think often people hold onto their positions in organizations using that tacit knowledge.
Yes.
They know that if they share this knowledge with somebody else, now they are replaceable and they are irreplaceable if they hold on to that knowledge for dear life.
Yeah.
And thus begins some really interesting organizational dynamics. But another conversation.
I'm not sure about the property part, but definitely I agree with you that a lot of people have incentives to withhold information and knowledge. So, you know, while in workplaces you would expect people, you know, there's a strand of literature that looks at this positive attitude about knowledge. We assume always that more knowledge is better. You know, there's a lot of people that write only positive things about knowledge, but we must also remember that knowledge is sometimes used to sabotage. People would withhold knowledge, just like you've explained now, maybe because they're afraid they will be replaced, or maybe...
And sometimes too much knowledge is also a challenge. I mean, if I think about it, just dumping information into an environment and just putting so much stuff into the space actually also kind of trips the trip switch occasionally. People just can't assemble their thoughts in an onslaught of information flow and knowledge. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the proverbial throw the new person in the deep end, you know. Welcome to the company, and we're going to now spend the next 2 days dumping, you know, a lifetime's worth of knowledge, tacit knowledge about what goes on here, into you in 2 days. We hope you get it. I mean, what could be more frightening than that type of scenario? So people can use it almost as quite a sharp and harsh tool if they would like, if they want to. So I get your point about too much can also be quite dangerous.
Well, I think you would, if you join a new company the first 2 days, you will get a lot of that formal knowledge and exposure to how to apply to leave and how to do this and how to do that. The tacit knowledge is the part that you get in the cafeteria when one of the older guys turn to you and say, everything that you heard in there is absolute nonsense. That's the tacit knowledge.
Yeah.
That's where people start saying, listen, you don't really have to fill in that form. As long as you put this total down there, nobody would ask any questions. Unfortunately, those are examples of tacit knowledge then.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about and we're talking about the concept here of knowledge transfer. I mean, why is knowledge transfer so critical in an organization? I mean, I'm hearing you, you know, you're talking about how we transfer the known quite easily, because you can just say to somebody, please go and read the manual, look at the procedure guide, whatever it may be. But that tacit knowledge, that doesn't transfer so easily.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And it often doesn't transfer so easily because of leadership. So one of the first things about tacit knowledge is that it's multidisciplinary. It doesn't follow a domain. When a master worker has a specific way of doing something with their hands, it may be very hard to explain. And they will only explain this to people that they respect. So, you know, you and I look like office workers. We don't really look like people that work very technically. So a person that is very technically able would maybe not so be so inclined to spend much time explaining to you and me how to do certain things. So tacit knowledge is hard to codify because it's multidisciplinary. It's hard to codify because trust is very, very important. And you need to create a social environment in your team, in your organization, where people feel like they are contributing to a bigger thing, and where the people that they are trusting with this information will use this information in an approved or in an agreeable way. So that is why, for instance, artisanship is so important, because you learn from a master, and the master reveals more and more knowledge to you, more and more tacit knowledge to you, as you go on, based on their perception of how serious you're taking this process.
And whether you're worthy to move to the next step through mastery of the previous one.
Yes, yes. So tacit knowledge transfers. And what is really interesting about this is, with the advent of Google and Wikipedia and the internet and social media, formal or codified knowledge, we are washing that. We're drowning in that. So everybody can now Google whatever, how to build a boat, whatever. The challenge is that tacit knowledge is very often local. So people in a small community where they physically meet, or maybe now increasingly virtually people would meet, and they exchange information, this is very, very local. So one of the interesting things in my work is that as knowledge becomes more available around the world, locality is increasingly increasingly important. So who you are near to, how similar to you they are, and how different from you they are. So we know that tacit knowledge, for instance, works much better in places where there's diverse knowledge. So if you're a leader in an organization and you only surround yourself with managers and executives that think like you, you would actually be sabotaging yourself, because you need to really tap into knowledge. You need to surround yourself with a diverse group of people that could agree to cooperate, but that will not always take on exactly the same opinion, because then you become blind.
I was going to say, in that sort of scenario, you may as well just have one person thinking, because that's effectively what you've got. You've got what I call group think happening. Everybody's thinking the same. You may as well have one person doing the thinking.
In small businesses, you often have that the starter or the founder, with their charm and determination and the fact that they've thought out a lot of stuff on the fly, which is often how you create some of your best ideas.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is entrepreneurship by definition.
So maybe in a small enterprise, you would find that knowledge flows much better, because you appoint people that trust you and you trust them.
And I was going to say, and you trust them. Yeah.
You know, so in a small organization, often knowledge flows much easier. It becomes a little bit more tricky when you go to bigger organizations, when you go beyond 50 people. Some people say that tacit knowledge doesn't flow over networks with more than 150 people. I'm not always so sure about that, but I've experienced that it's really hard. And then in the domain that I work in, where you go between organizations, knowledge really flows very, very difficult between organizations.
And is that a function of people saying, oh, well, you know, what I know, my tacit knowledge is, let me call it, part of my competitiveness. So I have no interest in sharing it with my fellow industry participants, which I guess is a valid construct in a way. I'm always interested about how things are captured in terms of, so how does tacit knowledge move into, let's call it, documented knowledge? So all it takes is one person in an industry to grab an issue and write something about it, write a blog. I mean, nowadays, you know, you write a blog about it, or you raise the issue in a discussion forum. And the next minute it's on Google and it's tracked and it's there. And suddenly tacit knowledge has now moved into the world of codified and documented knowledge.
Mm.
I guess, though, then you have to also at that point start asking the question, does a third type of knowledge not emerge? Because tacit knowledge is almost it's given its validity by the person who has the knowledge. Mm. So I have the knowledge. I'm the master. I have apprentices, and I give my knowledge to the apprentice. The tacit knowledge moves, and it's thus, let's call it, we understand the movement of the knowledge between the two, and thus the effectiveness and the validity of the knowledge is accepted because it's that master-trainee type of scenario. Codified knowledge, obviously, you know, on the other extreme, if it's documented and it's robust and all the rest, but now you've got this kind of, let me call it, land in between where, I mean, we've all heard that expression, if it's on the internet, it must be true. But the reality is if somebody who's got tacit knowledge on an issue writes a blog, for example, that now codifies effectively tacit knowledge, what gives it the, from a knowledge management perspective, I guess is a big question, you know, like, how do you know? I mean, so if I write something or you write something, you may look at the source and you say, okay, this is, you know, the tacit knowledge. I'm happy to accept this tacit knowledge and the opinion of the person involved. But what happens if, you know, somebody's just mucking around and, you know, putting their, you know, putting something into Wikipedia? I mean, I did notice the guys at WITS had a little bit of a challenge with Wikipedia about a week ago because the students managed to get into Wiki and changed the definition of WITS on Wikipedia and gave it a nice name and all sorts of lovely, nasty things. And I thought to myself, well, that just shows you how easy it is to change the knowledge, let's call it the knowledge, because it's unmoderated. It's not controlled. So it's almost a little bit like, well, if you've got tacit knowledge where you know who the source is, you can kind of tick it because you know that at a personal level, so to speak. When you've got codified knowledge, you know what your source is. But that kind of middle ground, I'm not sure if I could call it a third level of, or third stepping stone, you almost have to kind of go, well, the knowledge here is subject to the health warning of better make sure you understand who the source is and that you've almost validated source before you just say it's now codified. Because I think the problem is we don't see it often as tacit knowledge. We actually see it as almost codified knowledge. So we see it on the internet and say, well, it's on Wikipedia, so it has to be correct. It, you know, it's knowledge. Otherwise, why would it be there? You know, and if it wasn't true, somebody, or if it isn't correct, somebody would have fixed it or whatever. But the reality is you can't make those assumptions in the world of knowledge management on the internet, etc. So that's an interesting space to be in.
I think that if it's captured on Wikipedia, it becomes information again.
Yeah.
So the author maybe developed knowledge and they captured it there. But for you and me, when we read it, it's information again.
Okay. So, I get your point. So kind of it loses a rung in the status, potentially.
Potentially,
going from knowledge to back into information because it lacks the, let's call it validation, authenticity, source verification, whatever you want, whatever we choose to term it.
I think for leaders, you know, I when I walk into a business and I ask them, okay, so I very often work with leading companies and with industries. Work with how do we upgrade knowledge flows in a whole industry, like in the electronics sector and pharmaceutics. And you can very quickly, when you ask leaders, what knowledge sources, what knowledge streams or information streams are you plugged into? You know, what data streams are you plugged into? Whose data do you look at? But also looking at what stuff are your staff reading?
Hmm.
What stuff do you read? Because you said just now, teams are very often completely overrun and overwhelmed by all of these, you know, information streams. They're completely overrun. So we've shifted in less than 20 years from an environment where our average entrepreneur was starved of information to a space now where our average entrepreneur is completely overrun by knowledge. Our people are literally drowning in information. So one of my jobs then is to say, let's just start deciding which data streams, which information streams are authentic. Who do we want to listen to? Whose stats do we want to read?
And I want to just loop that into this concept of the rise of the knowledge worker mm-hmm. and how they should be managed. Because okay. what I'm hearing there is, you know, things have moved on. How you managed people in your organization 10 years ago and how you need to manage them now, it sounds like that's changing and moving quite significantly.
Yes, yes. And, it, that question ties a couple of the things that we've already discussed now. For instance, firstly, you manage the environment with knowledge workers. It's very hard to manage knowledge workers because they choose to share what they've learned tacitly into your organization. So your staff in your organization, this is not just relevant for knowledge workers, by the way, because I think all our industries are slowly but surely becoming more knowledge intensive. You are depending more and more on specialists. It doesn't matter which pay grade or what level of qualifications they have. Increasingly now, even to operate a machine in a factory, you need specialists. How you manage this environment, you need to create a space where people can build their own knowledge bases. So in a you say knowledge worker, in a very knowledge-intensive business, your average worker would be tapped into knowledge sources that you as the leader don't even know about. And you want to, as a manager, as a leader of this organization, you want to play some role in selecting some of those sources. So if you're a jeweler, maybe you want your chief jewelry designer to be subscribed to a really good quality, inspirational jewelry design publication. You don't want them to just search the internet randomly, selecting novel designs and copying something from a competitor and then ending up being in trouble. So when you work with knowledge workers, you have to create a space. And we always explain to people there are three ways that knowledge gets created in an organization. And this isn't in a company, but this is also in a government program or even in a university. You can create knowledge through experimenting. That's a very nice label because this actually often boils down to tinkering, trying stuff, and maybe sometimes even hitting it with a hammer to see, and then it works. Okay, so there's the knowledge creation through tinkering. There's knowledge creation through deductive reasoning. That's a clever word, but basically that boils down to thinking, mm-hmm. where people sit or stand around a whiteboard and they try to work something out, maybe do some, Googling and maybe check up some sources. But generally, it's a group of people or an individual trying to think through something. And those two, tinkering and this knowledge through thinking, deduction, you can do individually or in groups. There's a third kind of knowledge creation, and this is where you reach beyond your organization. And your problem there is you need to then adapt the language of whomever you are reaching out to. So that's where you phone your ex-professor. And if you have financial speak, you can ask them a question that is sensible. But a person that's running a small business that maybe don't know this financial speak won't even know what to ask. So that's the three ways that knowledge gets created. And leadership can do certain things to promote this. So you can enhance the ability of your team to think by maybe making space for them, maybe creating some rules about how much emails we send around to each other. And there are things that leadership can do to inhibit this kind of these three kinds of knowledge creation, like making a rule that nobody is allowed to speak to anybody outside the organization.
That would stop things in its track.
Or for instance, making it impossible for people to experiment. That, for instance, management do when you pay everybody on performance. Performance bonuses is a very quick way to make it dangerous, risky for people to create knowledge through experimenting and trying different options. So there's all kinds of things that you can do in an organization. I once interviewed an electronics company and as part of a study for a university to try and upgrade their university curriculum. And I remember asking the CEO of this company, do you guys do any innovation? Do you do any research? And they said, no, look, we don't have time for that. If the government gives us money, we'll do that. And it was quite a depressing interview. And then afterwards, the owner of the company took us on a tour of the factory. And electronics factories are really amazing. And this bunch of shiny machines standing there. And in one corner in a little room, there was a huge contraption. I can show you a picture just now. Blue PVC pipes and a dishwasher and a couple of green tanks. And I asked him, now, what is that? And he said, no, we needed to buy a really expensive device to clean PC boards. And my staff came to me one Friday and they said, listen, we need a PC board washer. And we have found a diagram on the internet how to create this. And that owner of that company had the guts to give his staff access to the workshop keys. And they took the company dishwasher, retrofitted it with oxygen tanks and purified water, and they created a PC board washer at a tenth of the price of importing a PC board washer from the US. And this owner of this company kept on insisting, we don't innovate, we don't do R&D. Until government gives us money, nobody here is going to do any product development or that. And at the same token, this guy trusted his staff enough to give them the keys to the workshop to convert their company dishwasher into a PC board washer. I don't know how legal that was, but it definitely was a great example of a company that where the person trusted his staff to come up with a solution that they thought about very hard. They had several diagrams, and they tinkered with several designs. In the end, they decided, well, the company dishwasher will be the ideal vehicle.
It's an amazing story of what the human mind is capable of. Now, just a question. I mean, knowledge management systems in business. I mean, everybody is willing to sell you a knowledge management solution, and
yes,
here's a price tag on it.
Yes.
I mean, where are you on those sort of things? Because we've been talking a lot about people and thought and capability, and those are not systems and process. So let's talk a little about knowledge management systems. You go and Google knowledge management system and you get a list of IT providers. Should you or shouldn't you be going down that road? You talked earlier about the knowledge management officer being the one capturing all the spreadsheets and all the information. What about a knowledge management system in your business? When's it needed? Is it needed? Is it a good way for IT people to sell some software? What's your view on this one?
So I've been working mainly in the manufacturing sector. I love our traditional manufacturing companies. So I'm not going to talk about the IT sector because I think in IT and finance, knowledge management is different because these organizations are often very big. So I think that in a smaller business, the first step to knowledge management is to actually create a space where people can, opportunities for people to solve problems together. So this is the first thing. You don't actually just go and codify everything because this is not possible. Very often, the knowledge reveals itself when you need to solve a problem.
Exactly. So rather move to managing knowledge having knowledge management in your business than a focus on a knowledge management system per
se. Yes. When your organization gets a little bit bigger, what I see people are doing increasingly is a first thing that I very often do at organizations that I help is we create a list of, and it's almost like a telephone book, of names and capabilities that they have. So you say, there's John. John knows how to fix almost anything. You know, there's Peter. He's the one that could fix this thing the last time it broke down at 2 a.m. with just a spanner. So you start capturing. So the first thing is that knowledge is captured mainly by people. So in one of my challenges in the manufacturing sectors, a lot of people don't want to believe that their staff dressed in overalls actually carry any knowledge. I always say they treat them like sheep. So one of the first ways to capture knowledge is to start by making it clear who to contact when you have a problem.
Okay. So that's quite an important list to have.
It's a very important list.
The hit list of, who to call when it goes wrong at 2 a.m.
Yes. Companies very often have these, like what to do when the company doesn't want to approve your leave form, but you want to actually formalize this for some positive use also.
Okay. Now, Sean, I mean, fundamentally, if I was a small business right now listening to you, what are the, give me, that's in closing, just two things that you'd say, hey, if you do these two things, you will move your business forward in terms of the whole, let's call it the dynamic of knowledge management within an organization. What would those two things be?
Okay, so I like to connect the topic of knowledge with the topic of innovation, because in the end, what we really want to do is we want to manage knowledge so that we can become more innovative. So the first thing that I like to do with companies is we need to create space for our staff to think. We need to create space for our staff to, around a whiteboard without management necessarily overseeing this, unpack a problem, identify some constraints in the business environment, and maybe allow the staff to identify what kinds of knowledge or information or data they need to make sense of the situation. So that's one practical thing.
So fundamentally, you're also saying they listen to your people.
Listen to your people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Listen to your people. I've done workshops with a piece of duct tape over the CEO's mouth because you just need to sometimes get management to shut up and just listen.
Now there's an innovative thought. I've got to get that into our business thoughts for the day, Andre, and that's going to be when you're having a workshop, sticky tape the CEO's mouth shut. Oh, that's a brilliant one.
The other thing that we do is you start creating space in the business, because the other thing that management does, you don't realize because you're a total workaholic and a freak because you get up at what time and you work until what time, your staff starts copying you. And they don't see the time that you spend thinking, typically on a Saturday and a Sunday. But anyways, another thing that you need to do in your company is create space. You need to create space for teams where you say nobody is allowed to schedule an official meeting on a Thursday morning.
Okay.
Thursday mornings, people can assemble in small teams, or you in your office, you have some time to just create some space to think.
Thinking time.
Thinking Thursdays. At many of my clients, we have thinking Thursdays.
Oh, that's a great idea. Sean, thank you very much for your time. It's really been great. Some interesting concepts and thoughts. Thinking Thursday. No, I like that. I like that one. I've seen somebody else said a mail-free Wednesday.
Mail-free Wednesday.
Don't email on a Wednesday. So, yeah, there's a few good thoughts out there. Our guest in studio was Sean Cunningham. If you want to join our live SME audience, drop Kevin at leadershipplatform.com. Drop Kevin an email at that email address. Next up, we're going to get a little bit more practical with our SME development conversation. Stay with us. CliffCentral.com.